It's 3:31 on Wednesday, March 27th. We have a special board meeting slash workshop on Office of Public Defense. Call to order. If you'll join me for the Pledge of Allegiance, let's do the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. I don't expect to make any decisions today. It's just more kind of brainstorming and such. And we have Charlie Dow. He runs our Office of Public Defense. I was hoping someone from one of the judges, but we don't have a judge here today, but because there might be some interaction there. But we have some workshop session. We have some goals up there. At this point, I'll turn it over to you, and we'll listen to you, Charlie, on the new caseloads that were proposed to the Supreme Court, and maybe some solutions you have or some ideas you have, and maybe we'll just have a back and forth here after that.
All right. So I'll start off with saying that the PowerPoint I've got for you today was developed mainly with this idea that I think I've been discussing shopping around, of doing a 75% of contract and appointment level. But Ms. Pearson asked me if this is the most up-to-date version of this. I'm happy to say it isn't, because when the Board of Governors voted, it effectively made this not just a permanent plan, but potentially maybe phase one of 3 years of this kind of stuff. So with that caveat in place, I'm here to, you know, present some of the issues that, you know, you may need some explanation about, specifically for public defense cases. I familiarize you guys with court operations on the superior and district court side and how that's been happening. Our current contract conditions and what I've understood from, like, our, I call them competitors, but our regional partners, Yakima, you know, Spokane, what their contracts are at, as well as discuss, you know, the theories and benefits of the 75% proposal, and discuss what that would look like in the upcoming budget cycle, 25-26. Again, that's another moving target, depending on how this the standards discussion goes, and I can brief you guys on that as well. And then I've gotten very good about talking about this on my feet, so I anticipate I'd be able to answer, you know, most, if not all, of the questions you have. If not, you know, I'll be taking those into advisement and providing an answer, you know, as soon as I can. Right. So these are old numbers at this point, but the annual caseload limits for public defense attorneys, these are set. We're not. There are states that have no defense standards, no caseloads. But Washington State is among a number of states that I believe made the correct choice of trying to set caseload standards, because in states where you don't have that, you have defense attorneys taking on, you know, all number of cases. And what ends up happening is that you can only slice an attorney so thin, you start getting less and less and less quality representation per defendant, the more defendants you have. So some time back, Washington had promulgated some rules that set these caseloads, 400 misdemeanor cases and 150 felony cases. Right now, our county only contracts for 390 misdemeanors and 140 felonies. That's to account for a couple things. There's some collateral duties, you know, covering the occasional arraignment docket, which aren't your clients, but just kind of an attorney du jour, as well as potentially, you know, we never wanted to slip above an ethical limit and put somebody's bar license at issue. So, you know, we contract for that knowing that, A, we're going to be asking them to do some additional work that would be the equivalent of those 10 cases in, you know, in Superior Court, or those 10 in misdemeanor, and also as a stopgap to make sure that we're not getting the county in any kind of legal trouble by having an attorney, either contract or employed, slipping above an ethical limit and putting their license at risk.
Charlie, before you go forward, I got one question for you. It's just so I want to make sure I understand what people ask me about this. I understand what, you know, pretty much everybody understands it, what a felony and what kind of crimes are a felony, but a misdemeanor, is that like a hit and run? Could that be domestic violence? What, just a couple examples of what goes through for district court a misdemeanor.
The handy rule, just in common law, is a felony is anything that requires more than a year in prison.
Okay.
And a misdemeanor would be anything underneath that.
Okay.
A DUI is typically a misdemeanor. You get enough DUIs in your history, it becomes a felony, and we start talking about prison time.
Okay.
So those offenses that traditionally, you know, conjure up a, you know, time in Walla Walla, murder obviously is going to be a felony. But, you know, the further closer you get to that year, you kind of start slicing it towards, is this a misdemeanor or is this a felony? A great test case is theft. The statute on theft is a gross misdemeanor up to $750, and then above that becomes a felony, and then there's another rank of felony above that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So the rules also provide guidance that those annual case numbers are to be distributed reasonably evenly throughout the year. So the breakdown there is 33 misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors per month and 12 felonies per month. So again, those numbers for our contracts are 32 and, you know, years makes no difference, 33 months and 11 a month felonies. I have found our office has the discretion to appoint above a monthly limit, but I have found that that is a very quick and easy pitfall to get into. And I got a slide up here that explains that. The relevant court rules, before we get into the over-assignment, the relevant court rules are neither a defense attorney or a public defense organization, me, should accept workloads that, by reason of their excessive size, interfere with the rendering of quality representation. That's an ethical standard that every defense attorney has to adhere to. So not only is it behooved on the county to not, as a contractual obligation, over-assign a particular attorney on cases, it's on the attorneys themselves, their individual ethical obligations to not accept cases if they believe that they're gonna, if other clients are gonna suffer because of their caseload. So everyone kind of hems very close to that 400 or that 150 felony mark.
And another question on that, I know that there's been city attorneys and stuff that have been concerned about us not taking more and more cases to defend per month. So I'm glad to see that out there, because now that's something else that I can, you know, talk intelligently about, where it says case limits assume a reasonable even distribution of cases throughout the year. So yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one thing I've been hearing from some of the cities. Why aren't we, you're gonna expend everything at the beginning of the year, not have nothing left at the end. Heavier workload.
I frequently get the question of, like, if we have a new contractor, why can't we just assign them 300 cases and, you know, have it be done? There's a couple of really good reasons for that. You know, if you assign 300 cases on Monday, you're returning 300 voicemails, hopefully by Tuesday. So, you know, everybody suffers when that happens. But in the aggregate, what ends up happening is any case you assign in January over the monthly limit, you're essentially stealing from December later that year.
Makes sense.
You know, if we evenly distribute the case assignments, we've got coverage across all the year, all of these months. Whereas if we start, you know, doubling it up at the beginning of the year, we're ending up with a deficit of zero at the end of the year. So, you know, my take on this is I would much rather deal with 12 minor crises instead of one very large one. Now, last year I came on in the middle of the year and immediately started to put that hard barrier in there. Like, we're going to assign these, you know, per month on a per month basis, knowing that we had some attorneys that had been over assigned. We had attorneys cap out in May. Yeah, 400 misdemeanor cases in district court, 390 misdemeanors. By the time May came around, means that person couldn't take any assignments for the rest of the year. Not only that, that person was overworked and overtaxed on the amount of time they could spend on those cases, given that short period of time. I could, you know, I've said I could see how the frog got boiled last year. You know, coming out of COVID, all of us were very unsure as to what, you know, it was going to look like criminally. We've all you know, I live by the bypass. I hear, you know, people speeding by all the time. I know there's been an uptick in traffic offenses. You can see it, you can feel it. You know, how many times have you been flipped off by somebody angry? For some reason, everybody's angry on the road, and we've seen an increase in traffic offenses. We've also seen an increase in other offenses. In the beginning of 2023, I can see how that could look like. Perhaps this is just a rise and we'll settle back down. But, you know, so appoint a little bit more cases to deal with that month's crisis and then, you know, see it level off again. But if, it, you know, the next month you appoint a little bit more, you start getting into this upward trend of using all of your resources in the first 6 months and having nothing, you know, for the remainder six. Right now, we're dealing with the shadow of that. We have a significant backlog in district court because we had attorneys cap out in May, June, July, and we didn't have anybody to appoint. And, you know, no new contractors walking in the door. And right now, we've got people that we're trying to clear out a backlog from that that choice, effectively.
Can I ask you another question? I'm just curious, and I hopefully I won't have any more. But so maybe on the prosecutor side of the PA side, if there's so many prosecuting attorneys, they're going to probably look, I would imagine, if you have so many cases, they're probably going to look at the most harsh cases, you know, felons, and also maybe in district court misdemeanors where they're going to, it's more closer to that 1 year and do those to prosecute them. Potentially, how does that come out to where if you're looking at case caps and you're doing all this stuff on the public defender side, and I know you're trying to even distribute it throughout the year, but what happens about those ones that are more seriously charged with heavier offenses? Are you going to, is it something you would be picking on, you know, making sure those are covered more than some of the more minor? How does it work on that side of your side? I'm just trying to figure out, I understand the PA side, but how does that work? Because you may, there's some high profile cases, there might be some that are etching closer to a felony. How do you pick and choose if you had to pick and choose because of the lack of OPD, you know, public defenders? How does that work?
So there's kind of a natural split between felonies and misdemeanors.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got a different contract pool in Superior Court. We haven't seen the same sort of backlog there. You know, so those more serious cases on that end are being addressed.
Yeah but
within district court.
Yeah, but hold on. I just want to make sure I said it right. So let's say you had 10 cases in district court and 10 were more serious. I mean, or six of them were more serious and four were not. They're pretty much, okay, you know.
And am I triaging based on charge?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
So there's another rule that I didn't put up here, but there's a court rule that tells our office or our county, for those counties that have an office of public defense, that office is to operate as independently as it can. It's, you know, independent from the courts. The court is not to appoint attorneys. It's, you know, this office. The way a court could appoint an attorney is if it's changing under the new rules. But if I raise a white flag and close up shop. Knowing that, you know, when I started this position back in June, I knew, A, we have a public defense crisis. B, you know, I need to work to put the county in a position that's most defensible if there is any kind of litigation, you know, that arises from this. And that meant to me to protect the office from trying, you know, from any sort of either, you know, willful or accidental, any sort of hint of influence from outside parties. So additionally, there's just that practical legal concern. But additionally, that DUI has the exact same Sixth Amendment right as the guy who was charged with stealing a candy bar. So, you know, two strong things that speak to me, the ethics of whether or not we're going to provide, you know, quality representation to anybody. You know, I want to show up on every ball field that a prosecutor lays out for us. So the way we've been working through that is by picking a date that nothing can change. Arraignment is when a defendant comes in and pleads guilty or not guilty. It's a fixed moment in time. It can't be changed like many other court dates, like pretrial can be moved, trial can be moved. And in this way, that arraignment sets our priority. We've been assigning people based on oldest arraignment date, prioritizing those arraignment dates that are in custody. And in this way, like, if we're prioritizing based on when their trial date is, the other party, a prosecutor, could move and try and shift our priorities about. And this way, it's influence-free. So knowing that I may, very well be under the microscope for these decisions, I've been going about it thinking, how best am I going to answer this if it ever comes to, a litigation? And that's the approach I've taken.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. The steady assignments, the reports I've gotten from our contractors, since, implementing this kind of hard policy, is that it allows more effective client communications. You're getting, 30 people, and you can, reach out to those 30 people within a reasonable amount of time. And it's reducing the burnout. It's improving contractor retention and frankly, employee retention. But it hasn't solved it all. So caseload estimates. Operating off of historic filings, my office should be prepared to defend roughly 1,600 felonies in Superior Court, or 1,400 felonies in Superior Court, and 5,700 misdemeanors in District Court. This is based off an annual estimate of our county's obligation in District Court being to cover roughly 6,000 cases on the court side. And if 5% of those people don't qualify for our office, we should be prepared to represent at least 475 of them monthly. And then same kind of breakdown in Superior Court, 120 monthly, just over 1,400 annually. Okay, so District Court generally. Benton County District Court hears criminal matters arising from several jurisdictions. Our county has interlocal agreements with several of these jurisdictions to provide public defense. Kennewick, Richland, West Richland, Prosser, Benton County, and the occasional Washington State Patrol case that arises through the prosecutor's office here. They're split up usually by jurisdiction. So there's a Richland docket, there's a Kennewick docket, and there's a county docket. And these are heard usually at the same time of the day and in different courtrooms. This means we can't have, one attorney, actually efforts in my office to lately have proven that we can have one attorney covering three different courtrooms just out of necessity. But the idea is if we're going to contract with somebody, they want the assurance that they only need to show up for the one day and, they don't want to cover other dockets because it complicates things for them. So in addition to the normal docket day, there's, these collateral duties I was talking about before, first appearances, in custody arraignments, out of custody arraignments. And then for each case, there's a trial readiness hearing. And for many cases, there's an evidence suppression hearing if it's appropriate. At the top, we have our current basic contract rate. We offer contracts at a flat rate. We either compute that annually and just say, we're going to contract for the 390, so we'll pay you the monthly equivalent of that, or we do it on a per case basis. My straw poll from private counsel is the going rate in the private sector is anywhere between $2,000 to $4,000. So what would it look like going forward? If we had a conservative estimate of 6,000 cases in 2025 and 6,000 in 2026, those are the same numbers. If we think that there's going to be some kind of increase, which the Board of Governors kind of made sure for us, we'll talk about that. But, if we had some kind of great spike in cases and we had 8,000, we would need to cover 606 or nearly 667 cases a month in District Court. So these are figures I've captured from the districting plans. So the interlocal agreement has us, reporting, full caseloads across all of the jurisdictions. Curiously, our interlocal agreement also includes infraction numbers for Benton County. I've excluded those because we don't represent people on those infractions because there's no jail time contemplated. So the total number in 2017 to 2018 is close to 10. And then we see obviously a great large dip 2020 to 2022. There was just fewer filings. And we see it, you know, kind of a back to or return to normal, possibly even an upward trend going into 2022 to 2023. The last two bullet points are my estimates. If we just incorporate a 5% increase from the previous year. So, you know, total cases in district court, if we're seeing an increase in filings, 5% year over year, we might be close to 7,500 that we need to cover. Our current coverage map. We have two full-time staff attorneys dedicated to various district court dockets and a number of contractors. Those contractors will agree to either 100 or something less than that. So we do have some people that only have three quarters contracts. One individual that wanted 360 cases, so the equivalent is 93, and the rest are at 100%. Our current capacity with just that is 3,200, 3,300 cases annually. So if we go back to those numbers, 6,000, we have a deficit of 2,400 cases annually, 201 monthly. Okay, 75%.
So what happens to those, that 200 that we're short on a monthly basis, if that's the case? What takes place? Is it dismissed or what?
I've got some ideas. We just had a bench bar meeting recently. I'm going to be reaching out to some members from the private sector. I had spoken up saying that they were willing to accept cases.
Okay.
So hopefully we've got more contractors than represented there. We have some contracts that are going to be coming to the next board meeting for signature. Additionally, you know, ideas for thinking outside the box. A lot of community members are served by legal clinics in civil functions. Looking into how we can set up a legal clinic for, if there's a case that's a case type, a charge type that is very kind of unconcerning for public safety, it's like a fine or a fee or something like that. Let's fill the Toyota Center with every one of those defendants and work through them, one day. And, that may be something that happens permanently. You know, if we can give them the paperwork and just kind of work through it, that comes with some legal ethical problems. When you take on a client, you have a personal responsibility to that client. There, we would have to figure out how to make that clear if, that relationship doesn't exist. It's complicated, but we're trying to think outside the box.
So on that one there, that's where you're going to need our help. If you need our help in coming up with some solutions, or that's where we can be flexible and giving you some more ways to be able to do that, recruit. If there's anything we can do on that to fill that deficit, that's where you need to let us know what you need help on.
We'll do. I want to get the community partners before I come to you.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so it seems counterintuitive. If we limit everybody to 75%, I believe we could A, attract more contractors and cover more of the docket. What this 75%, before the Board of Governors made their vote, the thinking was this would allow for a private firm to take on an associate, have them work these cases, and allow them the 25% to go out and take on those $5,000 cases, still have the ethical room to take a private case while still having something that's revenue stabilizing for the firm. Been reaching out to defense counsel. Like I said, in order to cover just the current numbers, I would need 10 new staff or contractors. I don't have all 10. At last nose count, we've got 6 people that are kind of committing to this idea. So we would still fall short, but we would still significantly cover a lot more of the docket than we do now. Whether we choose to do this or not, I believe come next July, we're going to be forced to. So you know, I'm coming before you now to talk about, you know, getting ahead of that, implementing this plan now, because let's just get into it. The Board of Governors for this Bar Association changed those ethical limits. And while that's not necessarily the Supreme Court's, you know, statement, now you can only take X number of felonies or X number of misdemeanors. If you think about what they're saying, it's troubling. So if what they are doing is setting the hard deck of, you know, this is what the Sixth Amendment requires, you know, an attorney that, you know, is overbooked and overworked, you know, is not offering effective assistance to counsel if they're taking more than X cases. That's essentially what our Bar Association just said early May. I don't think we should wait for the Supreme Court. Like, I don't think there's any value in holding off and saying, well, let's see what the court does, because our Bar Association, our licensing agency, just said this is the ethical standard. And even if you're in the private sector, my ears would perk up, because if I've got 150 felonies and I'm, you know, covering overhead and you know, salaries and my own income with those 150, and they just cut that down to 110 or 90, do I now have 50 some, you know, potential clients that have a, you know, malpractice claim against me for not providing effective assistance to counsel, even in the private sector? Right. So though the rules as they made them apply specifically to public defense attorneys, I think what we saw was a strong statement saying, you know, we want to change the ethical standard. And quite frankly, I think they opened it up, you know, for private attorneys as well as, you know, public attorneys to liability if they're over that limit. In 3 years' time, that limit goes down to 47 felonies per attorney. So right now, 150 by July of 2027 needs to be 47. And not just 47.
What year you said again?
2027.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah. And it's not just 47. They're also implementing a case waiting system. So the case waiting system takes those more serious felonies. It essentially pushes a triage onto a defense attorney. A murder, for example, is going to be 7 of those felony points. So one person can only take 47 felony points. That's not 47 felonies. That's not 47 cases. That's not 47 defendants. You know, if you are assigned a murder and you sit down with, you know, the client and they say, I did this, I want to plead guilty, you know, how do we do that? And you work up sentencing and, you know, go to sentencing and, you know, do a change of plea, do everything, you know, you ethically should do. It might take you much less time, but that's 15% of your work year. That sentencing could occur within 40 days, and that's 15% of your work year gone. So private attorneys, you know, I keep on talking about private attorneys, if they're only going to be taking 47 felony points, their rate, in order to cover that, you know, their income and salaries and all that, is going to have to go up. And our qualification level, 125% of poverty, isn't going anywhere, which means this increase is going to leave a middle class that's being well served effectively of people who don't qualify for public defense and can't afford a private attorney.
You know, I kind of timing, because you mentioned it a couple times. But I know we've struggled with that. The county has. In fact, we even hired, I think, one or two people to screen people for the courts. And I don't think anything came about it, because I that's why I was hoping a judge would be here, because the judge is the one that assigns those public defense attorneys, right?
And the specifics of that process are all of those documents run through my office.
Oh, they do now. Okay.
We have.
So you're doing the screening?
Well, I'm not making the determination.
Who's making the determination?
A judge does.
A judge. Does the judge always adhere to those 125%? I mean.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I hear they're passing it out. They're passing attorneys out left and right just because someone requests one, even though they're a well-paid person. You know, that's anecdotal evidence.
So how do they?
But we hired a guy to in the past, one or two people, to actually, you know, confirm their, do you confirm their Social Security? Do you confirm their wages and labor in your office? And, you know, because those systems are in, because I know the clerk's office can get that information on what wages they were paid for the last year, what, I mean, all that's in the system, you know, those systems. Do you do that kind of screening, that level of screening? So if someone says, yeah, I'm an indigent, I only make this much, do you actually check that? So if they're truthful?
The answer, the direct answer is no.
Yeah, see, that's
so
where,
what I do these personally every Friday.
Right.
And so the conversation, it goes like this. I'm going to ask you these questions. You're going to tell me the answers as if you're testifying in court, because at the end of this, you're going to sign this affidavit under penalty of perjury and further imprisonment, you know, that what's on here is correct. And so, you know, I've had people fill out that affidavit and not qualify. You know, in some circumstances, their charges are so severe that they're held on bail. And, you know, that affidavit can be readdressed at any time in the future. Mm-hmm. So if somebody's held on bail for, you know, some wild, you know, crime spree, you know, and they've got bail of $1 million that they can't afford, in the time intervening between when I see them and, you know, possibly when we see them again, they may lose their job. All those things change rapidly for a defendant. So, you know, I, you know, for my own self, I can tell you the admonishment I give defendants, you know, that I'm talking to is very, very clear. You know, I try and get accurate information. I dive in like, okay, you say it's $2,000 a month that you spend. What are you spending that on? What I can say is those who receive state assistance of any kind, well, most kinds, pretty much de facto qualify regardless of their income, you know, or et cetera. So somebody who is on Social Security disability because of, you know, whatever has impacted their life, they qualify for a public defense attorney. So yeah, we are handing out public defense attorneys willy-nilly, but my response is, you know, because that is the community that we serve. You know, a lot of these people struggle, run into trouble, you know, and
I just want to make sure, I mean, you know, that the policy covers, you know, that we're assured that they do qualify, because in the past I've heard that hasn't been done, or, you know, and maybe things have changed since you're there now, but you know, they would just be handed out. Judge say, okay, you get an attorney, right? Even though a guy comes in walking in with a pocket protector, you know, you know he's working out, you know, in the area somewhere making a big, you know, I've heard that anecdotal stuff. So that's my concern, is that we have a good, because if we're going to be saddled. But you said that there's court rule also, Charlie, about, you know, this rule applies to defense attorneys and counties that provide defense attorney. What about, so there must be some of those smaller counties that they don't have an OPD, they don't have it. What does the county do there? If that's is the county responsible? That's, I asked our attorney, our civil attorney, you know, to do some research on that. You know, what requires the county to provide this service? I mean, I know there's court rulings, you know, WASAC is suing the state that this is their responsibility to provide this service, you know, the OPD and the cost of that. Is there, do you know, I mean, what do those counties do that maybe don't have the resources? What, you know, some of the smaller counties?
I can't speak directly to, you know, the practice that they employ. I can tell you what the rule guides, you know, those counties do. But before we move on, I just want to clarify the affidavit thing. Those affidavits, that same rule that makes our office independent from the courts has us, you know, doing those screenings.
Okay.
And that may be why, you know, that fell flat.
Okay.
But every one of those screenings is presented to a judge.
Okay.
And, you know, the attorney, me, who else is available for any kind of follow-up questions the judge may have. And then we keep those screenings on file for a year and destroy them after that fact.
You're talking about screenings for the qualifications.
The financial thing.
So, okay.
So, you know, if we do think that there's any kind of hinky answers, we mm-hmm. can look into that. And quite frankly, I have. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really once in a blue moon. And I mm-hmm. think those anecdotal things are mm-hmm. folks that unfortunately stayed in, lost employment, lost income, lost spouses, uh-huh. that kind of thing.
Okay.
Concerning side of that to me was, like I said, I'm glad you brought that up, because when I was sat in a district court for about, I think it was two and a half hours, and I know the judge said it was a pretty heavy docket that day, I guess, as you use that terminology, and there's at least 20-some people in there that need, the majority, every one of them needed a public defender. So you had 20 in 2 hours or closer probably to 30. It seemed like 20 or 30. Only one person did not. And the judge would say, do you need a public defender? Yes, done. Moving on to the next one. So that was a pretty heavy case of just public defender, public defender, public defender. One didn't need it. So to me, that's when you asked that question, I thought, how is it verified and being done? Because if we're saddled with this, as you said, we need to know that needs to be done. And so what I just want to make sure that that's being followed up on, because I know that you might say, yeah, you know, we're talking to them, but is actually followed up on, because it's going to be more important than ever to do that.
You know, for whatever reason, there's strong correlations between poverty, substance use, and mental health disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And I've definitely, you know, made representations to the court where, you know, say I'm just running late and like I see the name and I've had that client before, I know he qualifies.
Okay.
Right. And that's the circumstance where I wouldn't present the affidavit.
Yeah.
I would preside, you know, provide as an officer, record a statement saying, I know for a fact this person will indeed qualify.
Yeah.
I won't shy away from, you know, kind of the concern that there's mm-hmm. a rubber stamp about these things, but mm-hmm. you know, there's just so much of these people that do qualify because they don't have those benefits that, I mean,
that makes sense.
I could look at a guy, what shoes he's wearing, and know whether he's going to qualify, frankly, right? Like you just get to a point where you see the same things over and over.
You mentioned, you know, there are like 6,000 misdemeanors filed in a year and 95% need a public defender. Is that the 5%, the 5% don't qualify? Is that what that?
So let's be clear, that 5% is my estimate. I don't have solid numbers on who doesn't qualify, because.
But when you say 95%, that's your estimate.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, then that's, you know, it might be closer to 98%, really, depending on the docket, frankly. A lot more people, a lot more rich people will get in bigger trouble. If you have a very large embezzlement case and the guy's got, you know, properties everywhere, that's going to be in the felony land, right? So you see a different kind of percentage out there. But so about, you know, what the practice is mm-hmm. in rural jurisdictions. The rule says that in certain counties where there isn't a public defense manager or an office mm-hmm. you know, handling this, the court will select defense attorneys off of an approved list, and how that approval goes, I'm not sure. But that portion of the rule, if I'm completely candid, confuses me. So if the idea is to remove the hint or stain of the court, you know, stepping in and appointing their friend to represent, you know, and that friend's going to get some money from the county because of it. So you implement an office to handle that, right? So that's my role. Wouldn't that relationship between that judge and that attorney exist more in a smaller community? So, you know, I am curious as to how they operate that. But as for, you know, the current litigation with WASAC, I try to stay as far away from that as possible, mm-hmm. Other than, you know, to keep my head down and do, you know, what I can for the county. I can inquire with, you know, my counterparts in other counties, other public defense managers, to see what their experience is. I've been doing this since June.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's other mm-hmm. people that have that.
Yeah, I just, you know, I just wonder, you know, what little information, I mean, being involved with the WASAC for years, is that, you know, there was, you know, a ruling done in the courts that, no, the state is responsible to provide that that service, that public defender, and then for some reason, you know, and I don't know, you know, it's always come to the county. You know, I think what were we paying? We used to pay $6 million every 2 years. I think we're $9 million now, every 2 years. And I think the state gives us what, $300K
a year,
to, you know, to pay for that. Where, you know, and that's part of that lawsuit that the counties are suing the state for. I mean, I just wonder, and I wonder out loud, and you know, that you know, really is it somewhere written down that the counties have to provide. You know, why did it fall on the counties to provide this public defense? You know, that's, you know, I'm just curious if we as a board just said, you know, we're not going to do it, judges. We're just done. So you figure it out, judges. The courts, right? You know, are we, that's, you know, are we bound to that, or it's just always been done that way? So that's why we're here at this point. You know, I don't know where the lawsuit is with Wasik and the state, you know. I'm thinking out loud, you know, I'm just curious, you know, why we're in this position now, and as in the past, you know, how we got to this point. Because it's been an issue here at the county for quite a while, in Wasik certainly, you know, and I understand that the governors, you know, what I read was they're hoping this forces the issue with the legislature, right? By putting these caseloads, that maybe that'll force, you know, like the McCleary decision, you know, the schools forced upon the state, and the courts ruled on that McCleary decision, you know, and that's why all this money had to increase to school funding. Yeah, I read that, you know, the governors, well, maybe this will force that, the state to address this issue. I don't know if you would, you've...
You know, McCleary was such a good solution.
It's just, you know, it's typical, throw more money at it and it ought to work, right?
So,
yeah.
You're putting him out of a job.
I'm thinking out loud. You know,
he's putting me out of one job and right into the other.
I don't expect, you know, you to have the answer to that, or you know, but it's just curious.
I think it's a useful line of thought, right? Mm-hmm. Like if we pack up shop and say the county's no longer going to do this, there's, you know, I think some obligations, if I can put my mm-hmm. county community member mm-hmm. hat on, mm-hmm. I would be disappointed in the board, mm-hmm. you know, as a citizen. I think there's some obligations that every government needs to meet. Mm-hmm. If we set those aside,
mm-hmm.
What does it look like? If the court is going to be the entity that is appointing cases and appointing attorneys, we still got this problem.
Mm-hmm.
We still got this sure. caseload problem.
Sure.
It's not going away. And, you know, the court budget, it's got to come from somewhere. Part right. of it, you know, right. here, right?
Right.
So, you know, if we were to fold up shop, I don't think it really kind of moves the needle in Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's... You know, where you're getting at.
But, you know, like, you know, we have to under, you know, the legislature mandates a lot. You know, they mandate, because I see Greg sitting, you know, they mandate planning, right? Or comp plans and stuff. Usually the legislature will come up with some funding, right, to help the counties do that. You know, okay, we'll give you, you know, each county so-and-so, you know, it depends if they're a growth management county or not, you know, they'll give funding. Where they seem in this issue, they just, like, you know, turn their head and
I'm disappointed to know that planning is sexier than public defense.
Yeah.
I mean,
you know, well, I mean, you know, the lead, yeah, you know, and that's legislative policy where they decide that. I just wonder why you have a convicted ex-felon, you know, serving as a state representative now, who is a lawyer, and you know, you'd think that would be high on her priority list, but I've never heard her talk about it. You know, she's about, well, let's just you know, her policy issues are, well, let's just decriminalize drugs. That takes care of the problem in the courts, right? We just, no more criminal action against them.
Well, that worked out for
Oregon. Yeah, yeah, you know, we're there too. But, you know, that's what she, you know, that we got to forgive, you know, every conviction that was ever done. I mean, she never presses the issue, the policies of, you know, defending, you know, people in the sense of, you know, providing defense attorneys. She's just all about, let's just get rid of the crime, right? You get rid of all the crime, well, gosh, there's no crime, right? If nothing's criminally charged, crime's way down. Yeah, do we need, you know? Well, yeah, because you just made everything legal, right? I mean, it doesn't work, right? But that's the thinking of some people, right?
Very poor policy
decision. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's, some people think that way, you know? And so it's just curious why the legislature has never stepped up. When I was in the legislature, I never heard about this issue. I never heard that, you know, public defense was a growing part of the budgets in the counties or the city. I just never heard about it. But when I became a county commissioner in the last 6 years, it's up there now. I mean, you hear about it because it's costing us a lot of money, you know, and we have to find that in the budget, right? So
I think we're just a match head too, right? Mm-hmm. Going back to 6,000, you know, district court cases, right? Let's forget what I've got to cover. Let's say 5% of those defendants want to go to trial, right? So we've got to figure out 300 trials over the course of a year. I don't think our district court can handle, you know, 6-7 trials a week over 52 weeks. So, you know, while we're talking now, and I'm here to talk about the public defense capacity and the crisis, I think we are just the friction plate mm-hmm. of a whole lot of entities that also don't have the capacity, right? So do you have a judge? Do we even have enough jurors to call? Just Monday, there was a trial set to go, and they got 12 total jurors to pool from. It's not nearly, you know, you need probably 30 to 40, maybe 60.
My wife's a clerk, so I hear about, you know, how many they call in and how many people really show up.
Exactly. Do we have the capacity just as, you know, rote jurors, you know, if they're going to show up? Do we have judges? Do we have the physical courtrooms to do that? Because you still got to operate a week's mm-hmm. worth of docket
right.
somewhere. You know, those hundreds of people that Commissioner Alvarez saw have to sit somewhere. And then, you know, do we have prosecutors, to try those cases? It takes one fun thing about being on the defense is trial is a much more fun affair. It's easier to poke holes in the cheese than to, you know, have to milk the cow and churn the, you know, all that. So it's a lot of work for a prosecutor to work up a trial.
Sure. Sure.
So like I said, I think I am just, you know, the thing that's starting burning now, and we're going to see trouble across all parties in court.
Okay. Sorry to sidetrack.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
I just got to appreciate your analogies.
I'm a firefighter.
I just heard that prosecutors work harder than public defenders.
That's not true. I think they work harder at trial, and I think defenders work harder before trial. there's a lot of, I'll be perfectly candid. Public defense, it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's not like just normal defense. You don't get to pick your client. I've got clients that, you know, will cuss me out, attempt to spit on me. I've had clients, you know, try to hit me, you know, through glass, like, you know, in Franklin County, one guy. Anyways, there's unseen, you know, taxes. You know, not in terms of, you know, not just case representation, but you're meeting people on their worst day, and you're meeting people who are, you know, in the depths of problems, mental health, that kind of thing. And it's tough.
I always told people that, you know, what's it like to be in a police officer? I said, well, so it's kind of like the Jerry Springer show, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't call you when they're having a good day to tell you they're having a good day. They're calling because there's a crisis or something's happened, right?
Right.
So it's all, you know, a lot of emotions and a lot of, you know, it's they're looking for answers or leader, you know, someone to take control of the situation. Yeah, so.
You know, a great amount of effort is, you know, sometimes, especially as a former prosecutor, building rapport with a client is sometimes extraordinarily difficult. And, you know, I have that conversation right up front, you know, ask him. I've, you know, talked to people I've prosecuted in the past. Right, you know. So I found just trying to have a candid conversation and being open about that with them builds rapport. But that's the big effort, you know.
Right.
Okay. We can skip. I think we covered quite a bit of this. So the main key points here, you know, it's broken up across adult and juvenile division. But the number I want you to see is at the top there. Our basic felony contract case rate is 1085.72. Private counsel rate estimate anywhere between $8,000 to $100,000, obviously depending on the case. A very common one, assault B, assault two is a class B felony. That would run probably close to $25,000. You know, most attorneys want to see half up front in the private sector. So our current coverage map, it's a little bit sunnier picture, but not great. Again, we've gotten some more contractors. We've also lost some. You know, that's one of the big things I've been trying to combat is not just trading chess pieces with, you know, Franklin County or Yakima or whatever, figuring out how to import new talent and keep the stuff that we have now. Okay, so if we're talking about the 75% plan, I need to find 7 new staff or contractors. I think in Superior Court, this fight is a lot easier. Those cases are, the pay is just more lucrative, if we're honest. And a lot more people would want to take, you know, a higher revenue contract to provide that stabilization of revenue for a firm.
Charlie, are you, when you do the 75% and maybe have it on a coming up slide, but you're proposing that we would maintain or even, if I recall, maybe even slightly increase the contract rates. We're going to be paying more per case. So this isn't the contracts going down because the case counts are going down. It would be, basically, we're increasing the case rates.
So a full caseload, thank you. A full caseload now in the Superior Court is annually about $152,000. That $152,000 contemplates administrative staff pay, things like that. So, you know, one of the things I don't want to do is ask every contractor to take a 25% haircut. So, you know, what I was trying to do was figure out a new case rate that would punch closely to that 152. And cheating down, you know, 5,000, a new case rate would be up from 1085 to 1400 per case. And here's where the big penny drops. Those new standards with the new case numbers, we've got those case numbers. We've got to figure out, you know, coverage for more attorneys. That's one half of the problem. One of the things that the scheduling for testimony before the Board of Governors was pretty quick and, you know, tried to turn around some materials and do some research. One of the things I think that has gone very undiscussed is the new rules also state that it is unethical for an attorney to accept a flat case payment for a case. Meaning we can talk all the time about 1085 and paying a flat case rate, you know, for every felony. But I think going forward, you know, we need to start looking at transitioning to a hourly billing, you know, because essentially I can see the reasoning here. Let's say all three of you, you know, commit, you know, some sort of felony, right? And I get paid the same for all three of your cases, right? And let's say, you know, Commissioner Alvarez is, you know, telling me I'm guilty, I want to take accountability. Commissioner Delvin is like, wasn't me at all. And then, you know, Commissioner McKay is the guy who's spitting at me through the window.
I can
you know, it kind of engenders C+ representation,
right? If I'm going to get paid, you know, the same for all of you, I might not take your, you know, your meeting because you're angry and fitful with me. And I might, you know, take yours and work up a, you know, defense on that. But if I'm getting paid the same across all of it, we're not really accounting for how much time I didn't spend on your case or I didn't spend on your case. So, you know, I think the morals and ethics
creates a whole, I mean, personnel issue too, because then you're going to have to someone process billing and more auditing the hours and what. Yeah, I mean, that just,
I got more hits too coming.
Creates a bunch of
The rules also recommend that for an office of a, you know, particular size, that we employ an in-house investigator. And I think our size is getting close to this. We have to employ an in-house social worker. There's a whole lot of riders on this. So, you know, what I've presented here was the thinking before that vote occurred. And I've been sitting down trying to think of, you know, what I can add in here to really kind of change this. The only thing I can say is, you know, my permanent plan has now become phase one. You know, more troublingly, all of the rules come effective every July. So July 2025, we're going to have a new case cap, and we have to have a case rating system, and we should be, you know, implementing an hourly, invoicing system.
Does the court have to approve that? Has to be an order. They just can't do that on their own. Do they have the authority to do that on their own? The legislature give them authority just to set whatever they want to set.
Hey, okay, so this gets into gray area, and ultimately I break in favor of figuring out how to comply with it, right, for a couple of reasons. I think the writing's on the wall. Present at the board meeting was at least one justice from the Supreme Court that spoke in favor of it, Justice McLeod. So if that's a temperature of what the court is looking at here, sure. That board meeting was also prompted by the Council on Public Defense, which was tasked by the Supreme Court to reevaluate case standards. So the Council on Public Defense presented to the Board of Attorneys, Board of Governors, their recommendations. The board voted to pass that recommendation onto the Supreme Court. So what we're just seeing is a closed circle. The Supreme Court has asked that this occur. So, you know, writing's on the wall, number two. And frankly, between now and when the Supreme Court makes that decision, if they never do, we still have the disciplinary and kind of governing authority of our profession saying that this is what we should be doing. So, you know, we're stuck in this gray area. If we choose not to do it, I think there's a lot of legal pitfalls and litigation there. Whereas if we take a more cautious approach, hell of a lot more expensive approach, but more cautious approach, will be better suited, you know, once and if the court votes this into effect, right? If we start planning for this now instead of waiting, we'll be avoiding a whole lot of civil lawsuit consternation, I believe. And I would let Ryan, you know, speak on that directly, but, you know, that's just my, you know, from the hip kind of shot there.
The civil portion. No, just because you're saying, because we didn't go down to the lower recommended level, even though it wasn't approved.
Yeah.
But how would they prove that? Because if you're able to go ahead and maintain in our county efficiency and be able to do it so everybody gets a fair and speedy trial, and we show that, wouldn't it be a higher bar for them to try to?
It would be a client basically
coming
requesting the records of his attorney's cases and then filing a complaint with the board, which it may be similar, like the engineering, and they have a licensing board and there's complaints filed in that way. And
exactly,
they're not laws per se, but if you are deemed to have violated their ethical standards, you can lose your license.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Which means
I wanted to bring that up so you can answer that.
Yeah. So the practical implication is, you know, if we even have attorneys that are willing to do that, you know, in the face of the board's, you know, decision to adopt these rules, and those attorneys are employees with our office, let's just make the liability as direct as we can. If the board has said we need to, you know, reduce it just for even numbers to 100 felonies, and I assign that particular attorney 150 felonies, that's 50 clients that could turn around and say, yeah, you've got this great system. However, here's the record from the board and the reasons why they did this and the recommendations they made to the Supreme Court. There's a very, very well-developed record there to say this is what the legal community of Washington and the elected representatives on that board.
And that's what I look at. Like I said, I think Matt said it right. You know, you have your code of ethics, and sometimes your code of ethics is a higher standard than actually the law. And so I totally understand what you're saying. I totally agree on that.
That's the government, right?
Yeah.
They assign all this authority to different groups and allow like engineers to set mm-hmm. standards,
yep.
attorneys to set standards, and then, but then, one sense, there's no real check, balance, right?
You have to do something wrong in the engineering community. Yep. You have to violate, you have to wrong the client, and they report you to the board, and that's where that investigation begins.
Yeah, so. The standards. So,
I see it's 4:30. I'm nowhere near done. Do we need to have some kind of official motion to extend this session, or
we can go as long as the board's willing to?
Yeah, we don't have an ending time.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Unless we're going to postpone it to another day, in which case.
Well, I mean, we may very well. So Ryan's correct. You know, the last standards. I can tell the court that, or I can tell the board. That when the last standards were issued, there was a resolution for the county adopting that, and that's a part of this. And that's a part of this process as well. It doesn't say adopt these standards. It says adopt standards very similar to this. You know, so if we don't adopt these standards, we're in open water. Right. So this is, you know, like I said, dated information. The idea of increasing our contract rate this year. I've looked into it, and I can come at or just below being budget neutral, given how much money we haven't spent on contractors because of, you know, that the board had provided, I believe, something close to $1 million last year, and it's been burning a hole in my pocket and trying to find somebody to spend it on, but. Because we've gone so far through this budget cycle without spending that money, if we made these changes to contracts today, it would be budget neutral through the end of 2024. The big question is, what does it look like in 2025 and 2026? And the $1.7 million number there is, at this point, you know, purely a conversation piece, because we need to change, you know, how we're invoicing these things. We have no idea what that will look like. You know, we need to adopt that hourly rate. We need to adopt, you know, some kind of standards. These if the court, you know, imposes it and all that, the standards would be changing in July. I would, you know, advise the board strongly to consider doing this December 31 or January 1. Because if we change how we are counting cases in the middle of the year, it will be wrong-footed, right? If I'm counting cases, you know, for 6 months thinking, like, I can assign 140 felonies here, and that changes mid-year, we need to start, you know, planning that at the top of our budget cycle. And again, at, you know, the next year, January before the July, and again. So what I have been doing is reaching out. So the felony public offenders, their contract is on an hourly rate, and at least in Eastern Washington here. And I'm doing some more research to find out what is the best practice on hourly rate contracts to see just how that works, what the administrative costs of you know, doing those invoices is, what's the best practice, what systems can we use. Right now, I know that... Yeah, exactly.
The other observation I have of that is when it's per case, and you know how many cases have been tried, not enough people know what that contract is going to cost.
Yeah.
You switch to an hourly, you're not going to know how much this contract is going to cost. You don't know how many hours an attorney can spend on each case.
That's a scary thing.
We can't estimate, right? So the standards are based off of this RAND report, which, you know, sets a baseline of 2,080 hours a year, right? 40 hours a week. So if we are estimating all 2,080 hours to be paid, we can plan for that with the hourly rate. You know, it would be my hope that an attorney is spending, like, okay, so if what they've done in here is weighted these cases based on how many hours it takes to complete a murder, it would be my expectation going forward that in reviewing their invoices, that those invoices are coming close to that number. If they're going over it a little bit, sure. If they're coming well below it, I've got serious questions, right? Like if the state has said, if the, you know, ethical standard is a murder should take, you know, 200 hours, and one attorney took, you know, 20 minutes on it, I've got serious questions about who I'm contracting with and the level of service that we're providing to the county through that person. You know, so there's benefits to doing the hourly thing. I can get a better read on who is that C-plus attorney, who should I be looking to replace, you know, and who is doing a good job. And, you know, I guess 2080 would be the best number to estimate, you know, for an annual cost of a contract. I know the CJA panel, the felony panel, or the federal panel, pays roughly $167, $166 an hour, and that pans out to $335,000 to $340,000 a year. We're never going to meet that. You know, what I'm trying to figure out is how I can present to you a strong second, and, you know, see what we can raise that contract rate to that you know, it attracts, you know, new business, frankly.
Well, what about attracting new business? The question comes to me in my mind, and so yeah, we raise contracts. You know, maybe the attorneys just don't want to do this type of work. You know, there's not that many public defenders out there that are willing to do this type of work, and then we can't hire it, right? So we're not picking. We're picking Franklin because we're hiring a little more, so we're hurting Franklin, we're hurting Yakima, or, you know what I mean? I mean, how do you balance that if no attorneys are willing to do that? You know, do we all go, and I say this jokingly, do we all become, you become all of our mentors and mentor us for 6 months, and we start practicing law? Keep up as a county employees? I say that jest, but I mean, you know, with just rules.
I'll keep my teachings just to the public forums I'm available. But you're right. You know, how do we attract more attorneys? There's problems inherent with this rule, right? So I talked before about what it'll do to the private sector, right? If they see it and they think that, you know, they're going to be, you know, open to malpractice claims if they take more of those cases, they're going to take fewer. That's going to go up. That's going to create a suction out of our office to, you know, become an associate that's going to get paid more for the exact same amount of work.
So it's going to, bottom line, it's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
A lot of money. That's going to be a bottom line for us. It's going to be a challenging situation. Reallocation of funding.
Okay.
So, Charlie, did I hear you said is there like written standards on what a case should take to give us a baseline to that, or is it okay?
So
we don't have to go into it. I just wanted to clarify that.
There's a way to get to that number. It's not clearly written, but their case waiting system takes into account the amount of hours that case would take. And you know, you can kind of guess if you divide that by your divide 2080 by that case weight. That's giving you another value. So yeah, it's going to take a lot of money. there's no way around it, right? When I took this role, when I came to the office, I felt like I had a very clear understanding of what the problem is, and you know, a month in, I had a much clearer understanding and a clear understanding of a solution to the problem we had at that time. I knew there was going to be a lot of pain in the late months of 2023 and, you know, the beginning of 2024. But I had, you know, good thinking to get us out of that. What I've seen is that those goalposts got moved and got moved for the next effectively 4 years. You know, I'm going to have to come to the board and ask for significant sums of money if we're going to meet, you know, the obligations that we have. You know, we're going to have to figure out how to limit those obligations, you know, either through a more stringent screening process, which I'll be frank, like, I don't know if that's a good idea, because what we don't want to do is have people be concerned about being open and candid with us. You know, that rapport building is such a crucial part. And if, you know, we're saying we're going to investigate, you know, your claims and things like this, there'll be a chill on that, which, you know, won't be seen in money, but it affects representation. Additionally, I wouldn't want to put a chill just generally out there for anybody to apply to our office. You know, it should come as no surprise. I come into contact with people who are undocumented, and there's pretty clear, you know, responsibilities in that circumstance. And the one thing you don't want to do is represent somebody who's undocumented, but isn't comfortable telling you that, because if you don't know, you could walk them right into a whole bunch of dead ends, you know, and just not know. So it's that initial trust. A private attorney gets that trust because they get paid for it. A public attorney, it's an uphill battle on nearly every single case. You know, the common phrase is public pretender. A lot of people think that we are a cog in a mill, and we're just churning out pleas and things like that. Somebody else definitely could screen them. It's GR42 that shipped out of courts, and then I think they had a judicial resolution before GR42 that designated our office as. Yeah, I'm not making determinations as to who qualifies. I'm just asking them those questions. But yeah, we can definitely, you know, adopt another agency. But
would it pencil out basically cost, you know, return on your investment?
Percent? Right. You know, then we're talking about even more money.
Data for when we did that for 1 or 2 years.
Yeah, to see. That makes sense.
Do you recall what years those were?
During the CARE Act, or during COVID, I think, or right before COVID. Where we found the one-time money for
what?
To do that.
To do what?
Josie may know. To have a screener for financial.
It came out of public safety tax.
Did it?
Yeah.
Okay. How many years ago?
Oh, great.
No, it was. Gosh, it had to be. It ended before I became in this role, so it had to be at least 6 years ago. Yeah,
it wasn't CARES related.
It wasn't CARES related. No.
Yeah. Do you actually, you know? Because if you have a screener, the cost of screener, benefits, you know, are you going to, or is that going to come out for if you're going to reduce the number of cases? Yeah. So it'd be curious.
Yeah, no, it's there. It exists. But yeah, it was a defined, like a one budget cycle program that they put one time money across for, and then it ended. Right. And we didn't continue it.
you know, and that doesn't speak at all about, you know, these, I don't know how to even approach the budget need for investigators and social workers. I believe, you know, there may be opportunities to contract with social workers from the state agency. Additionally, we had received a substantial sum of money for simple possession, like recovery cases, you know, kind of a response to Blake, SPAR, as the board had signed off on accepting that money. One of the problems I have is, do I prioritize spending this grant money, you know, and essentially utilizing an attorney that I desperately need on a docket? And also, if I'm perfectly honest, I made a request for $190,000 expecting to get maybe 30% of that, you know, the $300K out of 9 million. They give us the full boat, which, you know, it's great. It's $190,000. It is concerning because I think it is a step towards, you know, essentially, you know, the state taking over offices of public defense. I would become a satellite, you know, of Olympia, which, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent. I've operated in states where that's the case. Colorado, you know, some of the opposite numbers when I was a district attorney were, you know, in the Colorado Public Defense Office, fantastic attorneys. It's a great system. The pain in getting from here to there is my concern. I know there's no decisions today, but it's my recommendation that we alter every single contract we've got now, have it end December 31st, 2024, and approve an increased case rate, A, to get people in the door, B, to get us, you know, well situated to be in compliance with those rules that I fully expected to come down. If, you know, we're not only seeing that we need to be in compliance with them now. And I believe, you know, we can make this budget neutral just because of how much we haven't been able to spend over the course of this budget cycle. And then, you know, later this year, I'm going to figure out 2025, 2026 and see where we're at.
July, July is when the Supreme Court has to make their decision.
No. Technically,
the board's current first round of recommendations goes into effect, regardless of what the Supreme Court says. That's made that the board's new recommendation.
That's a recommendation that when it comes to court rule, though.
They have a rulemaking process, and I believe where this sits in that rulemaking process, they don't have to have any kind of public hearing or public comment. That I don't think they even need to actually have some kind of public forum. I think, you know, if the all the court justices think it's a rule, they can just promulgate it and publish it. I am trying to keep a close tab on if they have a public hearing. I'm going to be sharing a lot of the same comments I've given to the board today. I don't think it's required that they, in this particular circumstance, even give us notice that they're going to pass it.
We do have a lot of moving parts. As I've been saying the last commissioner meetings, you know, different counties are having financial challenges. King County has theirs. They just brought up, I saw a newspaper article on that, and this is definitely going to be an expensive venture going forward. So, yeah, we're going to really have to think about this. Yeah.
Well, they gave them sort of. They gave them the ability to go out and tax their citizens more. So.
Yeah. So it'll...
Go ahead.
No, that's fine. So, yeah, we'll definitely take this in consideration. I think it's going to be a challenging after the next 3 to 4 years. I've been saying that if we don't steer the ship around and start reallocating funding, we could be in the same situation as other counties. So
yeah. Charlie, this number, the 1.7, that only assumes the 75% caseloads. That does not take into account the reduction that will occur again in July of 2026.
Correct.
Yeah.
So it's bigger.
It's bigger. That's what I'm stressing out.
To be perfectly honest, I haven't brought myself to do the math because I like sleeping at night.
I did the math in my head already. It's not fun. And I agree with you. Yeah.
So I, yeah, as we're going into the next budget cycle, I mean, we're talking a $2.5 million hole, yep, to meet these new requirements.
Right. And
just on this issue.
Just on this issue.
Yeah. And you know, effectively, we're going to have to budget for, you know, whatever the tail end of 2026, realistically 2027.
Right.
Because, yeah. And, you know, paradoxically, it also means that if we, as a county, decide to adopt these, you know, standards and implement this plan in January, I'll be in a position to explain to the courts, I'm fully prepared to do this, but we're not appointing cases above the July standard, even though technically where we stand in January, I could appoint cases over that. So it's a whole lot of complications.
They have stress balls. I need one.
I break them. any questions? Anything you guys want me to, you know, I got the, you know, taking a look in the screening process and doing some research as to what the practice is in smaller counties. What else can I bring to the board?
Buckets of money.
Yeah. All right. Well, there is one last thing, like before we kind of move off. You know, these numbers, the case rate, like, you know, I believe there's going to be a feeding frenzy for attorneys. I think that's obvious, and you know, my focus is going to be how our county can kind of jump that line, right, without, you know, hurting our sister counties, but how do we get more attorneys here? And, you know, there's one attorney I know in the area that, you know, he's young, he's new in practice, he's trying to figure out, you know, where he's going to make a permanent home. You know, if he's going to have a family here, if he's going to have a family, you know, things like this. And one of the things they brought to my attention was some postings from Yakima County. I'll just read you here. The annual hiring range, I think, is competitive with us for that experience level, $91,000 to $102,000 a year. But this is most troubling. Temporary hiring incentive of $12,000, $6,000 upon acceptance, and $6,000 after just 6 months of employment, from February 1, 2024 to January 31, 2025. And I know for a fact that that temporary hiring incentive, those dates have changed. They keep on rolling that forward. I took a gander at the county commissioner's resolutions. And we got to figure out a response here. It's
Yakima County.
Yakima County. Yeah, for any attorney.
Yeah. LaDon McKinney, we know them. We, you know, we got to be talking to those guys. No, I think one thing that we could also look at, I'd like to see the state legislator. I know Nikki Torrey is one of the senators and stuff to talk about internships, but also, it would be really great if the city, when the state would start kicking in and maybe talking about student forgiveness, and they fund some of that for some of the problem solving. That would be also maybe helpful in some, if we could figure something like that out. It's going to be a lot of brainstorming. I'm just throwing stuff out.
The loan forgiveness program, loan forgiveness program has me concerned personally. Right?
Do you? Okay.
So I went into law school knowing that there was a federal loan forgiveness program that if I made 120 payments 10 years as a public servant, that the balance of my education would be, you know, essentially waived, right? Yeah. Like, you know, forgiven. And there's dark corners there. If you reconsolidate your loans and if they're not carried by a federal loan servicer, you don't qualify for that anymore. And one of the concerns I would have is if you receive forgiveness, you know, from the state, does that somehow change your qualification, you know, for that public service loan forgiveness program? You know, so, you know, I got six figures riding on that bet, you know, that, you know, Congress isn't going to change that rule and that, you know, they're going to honor, you know, my now going on 7 years of service. And, you know, if they don't, you know, we're sunk, then, yeah, I'll apply to the state system. But I wouldn't do anything to jeopardize that, okay. I guess is my point. And then, you know, as for, you know, their hiring bonuses, it wouldn't be my recommendation to match that. But, you know, I may be biased. I will say I will be as biased as every member of the board that I think living in the Tri-Cities is a lot better than Yakima. So I don't think we need to, you know, come up with something that would match it in order to be competitive. That attorney is thinking of leaving because of that. And, you know, we need a strong response for that.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, go around in circles.
Mm-hmm.
$6,000.
Everyone's doing it. Everyone does it. I think
the one market indice I keep an eye on, because I think it has direct impact on, you know, public defense, is the regional mortgage rate. I think if we see that go down, we'll be able to walk back some of these incentives, say. We'll have more of a buyer's market, so to speak, because it's much easier to move. I'm sharing a lot of personal details here, but, you know, I've got a loan at 2.75%. I'm not moving anywhere.
You're talking real estate.
Yeah, right? Like, you know, there's no chance I could afford to move somewhere.
I don't have a loan. So.
La-dee-da. I got loans coming out everywhere.
But, you know, I watch the Business Channel anymore. And, you know, now they're down to what, 60 chance the Fed is going to do one rate reduction this year.
I've been shocked at how, like, how much that's been informing, like,
because inflation's still there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so,
well, that cuts both ways, though. If people are more willing to move, they might jump ship and take that hiring bonus. So, yeah. I mean, you got to be careful with that.
I think the other counties are going to be doing the same math.
Right.
And I wonder if those hiring bonuses go away with that mortgage rate decrease, if, you know, there's more fluidity in right. the job pool.
As Carly just pointed out, though, I mean, what we saw even during COVID, when, you know, hiring bonuses became all the rage, is people worked there just long enough to get their bonus and then they left. And yeah. they weren't really effective at keeping, I mean, recruiting people is great, but we all know how expensive it is to train and get somebody up to speed, and then have them walk out the door 12 months later. It wasn't worth it. And so maybe I don't disagree with you that we need to be competitive in that, but maybe we need to be also creative with something that's a longer term incentive. If, you know, if there's something that we, you know, I know you're concerned on, but is there a way that we could help pay school loans or those kind of things that would encourage people to stick with us for that 10-year period, so that they're making their payments, but then we also are getting them qualified for that forgiveness. And so I don't know.
You know, the question as to, you know, staff, attorneys, and contractors is
right.
obviously complicated. I've been thinking, you know, we're gonna put an asterisk next to this as not fully thought through by Charlie, but maybe worth talking about. How do we get contractors in if what we have to do is, you know, an hourly billing, right? Go back to those 49 case points, 7 murders, right? If you assign me as a private attorney 7 murders, I have no guarantee on how much I will actually be able to bill on those, because if all 7 of them want to plead and I spent, you know, 200 hours for the year, you know, that's my income.
Right.
So, you know, the things that wake me up at night, is this, like, how do I give a contractor certainty of an income? That's what they want. That's what they're buying.
Right. Yeah. Cause if they do our 7 felony cases, they eat up all their point. Well, they can't go take even private cases.
Correct.
What was that?
I don't know.
So, mouse. you know, one of the things I'm going to be looking into
over there shooting rubber bands.
One of the things I'm going to be looking into is, you know, with this hourly model, is can we adopt it as if, you know, we were a private citizen hiring an attorney, pay them a retainer. So, you know, a retainer is just a lump sum of money up front that then they would bill through. And once they hit that retainer, they start invoicing us for anything above it. So, you know, can we do this? How to do it? Do, you know, do we just pay them a retainer of 50 grand? That right there, right? Like, you know, if what we're expecting to pay them is well north of six figures, if we hand them 50 grand, obviously there's arguments against this, but, you know, the thinking is, you know, somebody outside the area could use that money to move here, start working, start billing that through that. If it's 50 grand or 5 grand or, you know, whatever, if we, you know, front them X, that's essentially like a response to a hiring bonus on the contractor side that we would still get, you know, payment through, right? Still get some kind of service through our, you know, through hourly billing. Yeah, I'm still working through that one, but, you know, is it?
It's not 5 o'clock. Call it.
Okay.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you. Then I'll, I don't know what time is it. 5:01, meeting adjourned. Thanks.